Good evening, good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. When Paul Leclerc and I met out in Los Angeles, he said to me that he saw my mission as to oxygenate the library. He said, I want you to oxygenate the library. And it is a term that actually struck me and made me decide to move to New York. Even though when we arrived at JFK, the first thing I saw was ozone alert. I don't say this anymore much, partly because I've said it about 250 times, but with the presence here of the president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc, I feel compelled to at least one last time, perhaps, so don't trust that, to tell you how I transformed the word oxygenate into something else. I said that my goal at the library is simply to make the lions roar. I've said this 100 times, and sometimes actually to make them rap, as for instance when we had Jay-Z. I've also said that my goal is to make a heavy institution, and I've always wondered how much actually this institution weighs, and nobody has been able to tell me, 62 million items, to make this heavy institution dance and, when successful, to make it levitate. Speaking of heavy, before I moved to New York, Paul Leclerc called me up to say that he was delighted that I accepted his offer to oxygenate the New York Public Library and added, in a nice, quiet, but firm way, that he noticed that on my moving estimate, well, I found out that day that I had 16,000 pounds of books. And his mention, I don't know if he remembers, he said, but we have books here. Now, this reminded me of a wonderful line. I've spent many years living with Walter Benjamin, the German philosopher in a ménage à trois. And he wrote a wonderful essay called Unpacking My Library, Ich packe meine Bibliothek aus, where he says, but one thing should be noted. The phenomenon of collecting loses its meaning as it loses its personal owner. Even though public collections may be less objectionable socially and more useful academically than private collections, the objects get their due only in the latter. Now, this may be an interesting subject for us later to talk about the difference between public and private collections. Now, this is a good occasion for me also to tell you that the New York Public Library, in some way, you may not know this, but at least I've come to know this in many meetings and in hearing people talk about funding, the New York Public Library really is perhaps to some extent a misnomer. It is public because you can go and, if you are so inclined, see the manuscripts of T.S. Eliot as revised by Ezra Pound within about 7 to 12 minutes of arriving at the library without any credentials other than your curiosity. This may be different from France. And the New York Public Library may be, in fact, a misnomer in a different way. It may be the New York Private Library at the service of the public, funded so much by your generosity, by patrons who support it. And tonight, as we speak about its future, it seems appropriate for me to ask you to support the New York Public Library, its collections and its programs. If you are not already a friend of the library, please become one tonight. I would be grateful if you did, and I think I know for sure that President Paul Leclerc would be as well. Quickly, let me mention what's ahead. We have quite a week ahead, a couple of weeks of program. On Sunday, together with the Penn World Voices Festival, we will be presenting Jonathan Galassi speaking about Leopardi. I will be interviewing, debatably, the greatest living literary critic, Harold Bloom, and Voyl Soyinka, the Nigerian 1985 Nobel Prize winner, will deliver this year's Arthur Miller Freedom Lecture entitled Humpty Dumpty Still on the Wall. Then next week, Ralph Nader will be speaking to two billionaires, encouraging them to give back even more than they have. Ralph will be in conversation with Peter Lewis and Ted Turner. That is on May 4th. On May 5th, I will be speaking with Elizabeth Gilbert of Eat, Pray, Love fame for her last speaking engagement, she tells me, for the next 2 years. And on May 11th, Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records, will be speaking about the 50 years of Island Records. He will be joined by some wonderful friends. I won't say more. And then finally, on May 21st, we will be participating in the centennial. As you probably know, the library will be celebrating as a building 100 years the weekend of May 20th with an event we are co-hosting with the Moss. Some of the Moss girls are here tonight, the fabulous storytelling group. The evening is entitled, and I think they can take credit for it, though I would love to take credit for it, but they are here tonight, Reading Between the Lions. And I'm happy to say that Paul Leclerc has agreed to tell a story that night about his nearly 18-year tenure at the New York Public Library. To introduce Paul Leclerc and also the president of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, Bruno Racine, who I wish to warmly welcome, we have Shani Pierre, the director of the Maison Française at Columbia University. The Maison Française is co-sponsoring tonight's event, and I hope this is just the start of a lifelong romance between La Maison Française at Columbia University and live from the New York Public Library. Shani Pierre.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's such a pleasure to be here. And a great honor and privilege to introduce tonight's very special guests. Both men are so accomplished that I can only offer a glimpse of their brilliant careers with this brief introduction, and that's what I shall try to do. Paul Leclerc was described by David Remnick in The New Yorker as an unassumingly brilliant administrator and Voltaire scholar, which sums up in 7 words the 2 dominant facets of his professional life. One might say that Paul's double identity was written into his name. Leclerc is, of course, a French name. Paul's grandparents were French-Canadian immigrants, and French was spoken in his childhood home. And the meaning of Leclerc in French is the scribe. And, of course, in the Middle Ages, it was the scribe who recopied manuscripts by hand in order to conserve, circulate, and transmit written works and learned culture from one place and one generation to the next. And this is the role Paul has played so beautifully at the library. For the past 17 years, Paul Leclerc has led the New York Public Library to unprecedented levels of accomplishment during a period of rapid and ever-changing, ever-accelerating change in the way information is produced and exchanged. More people are now using the 90 libraries that make up the New York Public Library system than ever before, both physically and online. And the New York Public Library is widely recognized as being the most democratically accessible library in the world today, which is a source of particular pride for Paul and for all New Yorkers. Side by side with his identity as an administrator, Paul has always maintained as well an orientation toward French culture, and in particular towards the French Enlightenment and its leading author, Voltaire. Paul received his PhD with distinction from Columbia University, and we are deeply honored that he currently serves as the chair of the advisory board to the Columbia Maison Française and Department of French. He is the author, editor, or co-editor of 5 volumes on Voltaire and the Enlightenment, all based on research carried out at the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. And Paul is especially proud of 4 exhibits that he helped organize at the library, 2 in collaboration with the Bibliothèque Nationale, which were Utopia in 2000, and Renaissance Bindings from the Royal Libraries in 2003. Paul's work has been lauded in both the U.S. and Europe, and his many distinctions include honorary doctorates from Oxford University and the Nouvelle Sorbonne, the Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur and Officier des Palmes Académiques, and most recently, the Spanish Minister of Culture, on behalf of the King of Spain, made him a commander in the Order of Isabel the Catholic, which is Spain's highest honor in the field of culture. And as Paul looks toward his next life chapter, one central project is a biography that will bring him back full circle to the French 18th century and to Columbia. And so we thought this dialogue with Bruno Racine seemed to be a fitting way to celebrate his years at the library and to look forward to spending more time steeped in the French 18th century at the Bibliothèque Nationale. So our other special guest tonight is Bruno Racine, who was appointed in 2007 as president of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, which is, of course, the library that traces its origins back to the Royal Library founded in the Louvre in 1368, and which is now housed in one of the most modern and largest libraries in the world. Bruno Racine previously held a number of senior positions within the French government. These include Director of Cultural Affairs for the City of Paris, Director of Policy Planning Staff in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Director of the French Academy in Rome, President of the Pompidou Center, and Bruno Racine also presides France's High Council on Education and directs the board of the Foundation for Strategic Research. He's a graduate of the École Normale Supérieure, Institut d'Études Politiques, and École Nationale d'Administration, and holds an agrégation in classics. He's a member of the French Court of Auditors and was named an officier de la Légion d'honneur. Mr. Racine has also written 6 novels and several best-selling nonfiction books, including Art of Living in Rome and Art of Living in Tuscany, and he's been awarded several major French literary prizes for his works. His most recent book, very timely for this evening's discussion, is Google and the New World. Tonight's conversation will, of course, be moderated by Paul Holdengraber, who is the director of Live from the NYPL. You just met him. This program has been characterized by Publishers Weekly as the Holdengraber happening, which has brought intellectual sparkle to book events at NYPL. So we now turn the evening over to Paul, whose job, as he says, is to make the lions roar, rap, and rock. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here, Paul Leclerc and Bruno Racine, to welcome you, Bruno Racine, to New York City and to the New York Public Library, coming from a very great library which you direct in Paris. And I don't know that I have ever actually spoken to 2 presidents at the same time, but it's a great pleasure, and I'm looking forward to it. Whenever I think about the future, I always think about Paul Valéry's famous line, which you probably know, that the future isn't what it used to be. But the future of the library, the future of libraries, has in fact already been described, at least by one critic, one great scholar, Anthony Grafton, who in Codex in Crisis looks at the newly built public libraries, for example, the library in Seattle, which don't even have, as he says, a reading room. The architecture of these new libraries, according to Grafton, seems to say, and now I'll quote him and have you react to it, "Libraries are such a dinosaurs, doomed to extinction, but build a really attractive building and call it a central library and mall with natural light, interesting spaces, and a comic book shop, like the new library in Salt Lake City, and the punters will come, not for the books, but for the excitement and the human connections that only a great public space can generate. Libraries, in other words, can survive, but if they insist on their original mission, they will turn into enormous, handsome ghost ships sailing along with all lights on and no passengers. On the other hand, if administrators decide that they can save libraries by sweeping all their dusty, old-fashioned books into off-site storage and filling their cavernous, loft-like spaces with cafes and fast computers that might woo crowds back, These treasure houses will degenerate into bigger versions of Starbucks and Barnes & Noble, splendid public spaces which people frequent to use electronic sources, most of which they could find anywhere. Neither fate seems desirable, and neither will restore the old function of the library as a training center for the crafts of scholarship. So, Bruno Racine, let's start with you.
That's an easy question, but before I answer, I'd like to say it's a privilege for me to be here, and I would like to thank Maison Française and Chaîne Épée and the New York Public Library for this invitation, and I'll tell later perhaps how much we admire and respect Paul Leclerc for all his accomplishments. Now, since we are supposed to imagine what the future of libraries is going to be, I have to say I'm in charge of a library who has existed more or less for three centuries as a national, as open to the public, and which tends to think that it's eternal. And since among our missions we have to preserve the millions of objects, not only books, but also prints, photographs, coins, medals, etc., etc., we think that we will still exist in some centuries ahead, at least as keepers of this heritage. Until very recently, an institution like the Bibliothèque Nationale was open only to a restricted elite of scholars. When it was decided to build a much more modern building, it was decided by President Mitterrand at the time to have also a public library open to anyone and above 16.
Above 16?
Above 16, yeah, with no children allowed yet in the library.
This is the case then?
Yes, absolutely. And, well, we have seen over the last decade the number of people attending, coming to the public library decreasing, regularly decreasing every year, while the research library is growing actually. So if we think that this is a long-term tendency, indeed, the public library could be empty in one century or perhaps before that. So the fear that the libraries could be deserted is not groundless. But at the same time, when I see the reading room here, or our own reading rooms, I'm absolutely convinced that in cities like Paris or New York, with million inhabitants, you will always find 1,000 or 2,000 people every day who are willing to come to a place where they can work, study in a quiet and silent environment.
Willing?
Willing. And yes, absolutely willing. They won't want to be forced into the library. And I'm sure that this need will still exist. Of course, we can have in mind what the British Library is doing, transferring most, the major part of its collections to a site in the beautiful English countryside. But this is mostly because they lack space, and as you know, the price of a square meter in London is very high. But it's a different model, in which indeed the books, there is a physical separation between the readers and the books, and of course this is because they anticipate that large part of the collection will be digital or digitized, and therefore that access can be provided online or even possibly for legal reason on site, but without the physical presence of books. So in the next 10 or 20 years, certainly we'll see major changes in the way the libraries are used. But again, I'm convinced that if we have a proactive policy also, if we are able to show that it's not only a place where you come only for because it's silent, and we can have, it can be
full. But you come there also for what then?
Sorry?
You come there also for what? What does a proactive...
There are also events like these, exhibitions, advice, etc., etc. Because the site, when we are fortunate enough in the New York Public Library or in the Bibliothèque Nationale to have huge collections, which are not known for a large part of them, and this is an incredibly rich material.
Paul.
Well, first a few preparatory remarks, and to thank Shani Peer again for having invited President Racine, and for Paul Holdengraber for having accepted the suggestion that this be a co-sponsored event and take place here at the library. And a very, very special thanks to my colleague Bruno Racine, my friend, who has come all the way from Paris for this, and I have to admit to my immense admiration for many things about him, but especially for the fact that this is 1:30 in the morning in Paris, and he's doing this in English. And I couldn't do it at 1:30 in the morning in English here in New York. And so it's really an example of extraordinary stamina. And
I'm not an early riser. Okay.
And so you're asking me to go easy on him.
Well, I think so.
Okay.
And also to be on the record as saying that for me, the Bibliothèque Nationale is the place where I think I really came of age as a researcher. And over the course of many, many years, I was a reader there every single year for a greater or smaller period of time. And nothing that I ever wrote, I think, could I have written or published without the collections at the BNF, used to be the BN, and without the support services of the staff that are there. Thirdly, and finally, before really sort of opining on Tony Grafton's statement, I revere him as an historian. I think he's one of the single greatest historians writing in the English language today. He's a very, very good colleague. He's given me advice on curators for exhibits here at the library. He's written wonderful reviews of exhibits that I've had a hand in the New York Review of Books. At the same time, I find it very hard to agree with very much of what he said in that essay. I've seen the Seattle Public Library. It's a piece of architecture as a functioning library. That may be another matter. But he begins by saying it seems that a place like the Seattle Public Library is no longer a research library. Well, I would have to say, was the Seattle Public Library in any building that was ever in a real great research library? I suspect it was a really great public library with holdings that the public would be interested in, but not a place of deep scholarship. It is true that public libraries increasingly and quite appropriately are seen as anchors for their communities. I'm speaking in a New York context only, and as places that offer a multiplicity of services for the people in that community, ranging from training in English as a second language to adult literacy for native speakers of English, but who are reading and writing at the third grade level, let's say, to teen spaces where there are video games, which we're all in favor of, to DVDs that people can check out, to online computers and laptop computers that people can use in wireless spaces, to helping people find jobs in a difficult economy and to write a resume online and do email a resume because they don't know how to do that, and most jobs are posted online. And if you look at public libraries, as I do and as we do at the New York Public Library, as places that help build human capital, which is, I think, an incredibly important, the central function of a public library in a place like New York City, then all these things, including checking out books, and we are now the highest circulating library in America. So it's not that books are staying on the shelves. And I've been doing a sort of farewell tour of all the libraries in our system. And I was at one in the central Bronx today. And the librarian there told me that they're now requiring materials in Arabic and in Chinese and in Korean because people for whom those are the native languages are moving into that neighborhood that is otherwise predominantly minority, basically Latino or Central American people. And those books are being taken home, and the children's books are being taken home. And we have to remember that an enormous number of people in New York City are leading very marginal lives from an economic point of view. A lot of our patrons can no longer afford to buy a book. They can't afford to buy books for their children. They don't have wireless access at home. And libraries are the only places where they're going to be able to get those kinds of services and those kinds of materials to take home for themselves or their kids. Also, it's important to note that last year in the five boroughs of New York City, there were 40 million physical visits to public libraries, which I think is more than any city, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, and maybe in the world. So if there's a place where libraries are really relevant to people in all different kinds of ways, and we're not judgmental about what those should be, then I think it's New York. Now, it's important to make another kind of distinction between public libraries and research libraries, and that is that on the research library side, there are several different formulae or formats or charters in which a research library could exist. Europe is quite different from the United States in that the United States, the great, great research libraries are two that are quasi-public. There's the Library of Congress, first of all, is the nation's depository library, which is three times as big as any other place. But that's not open to the public. You just can't walk into the reading room at the Library of Congress and sit down and write a poem. They're very difficult to access that library. Then there's the New York Public, which is a private library open to the public, as Paul has said, as a consequence of private philanthropy, where we get very little support for the research libraries here from the city or the state. Two-thirds of...
What percentage?
Well, the city operating support for this building, the Schomburg Center, the Library for the Performing Arts and the Science Industry and Business Library is 22% of the budget. The state puts in a bit more money, and after that we're on our own. So the second third comes from the endowment. The third third we have to raise. So we have to raise about $1 million a week privately, which no one knows. I mean, I did when I was a reader here for many, many years, I didn't realize that I was enjoying the privileges of this library because of philanthropists in New York and friends of the New York Public Library.
I actually remember, if I may quickly say, that once when I asked you if you would come to a particular event, you told me that you couldn't that evening because, you know, every evening was a potential evening for $100,000.
Well,
and
there are trustees, I think, here this evening.
Even though the person I was inviting was wonderful, still.
But then other than the Library of Congress and the New York Public, which are magisterial collections, then there are the great university libraries that are sort of dotted all over the country, both in the public sector and private sector universities. In Europe, the great libraries tend to be the national libraries, or in the case of Germany, the state libraries. And so one shouldn't speak too cavalierly about libraries
in
general.
And you think he does in some way?
Well, he's a friend. He's a great historian. I wouldn't want to...
Countrymen, lend me...
Yes, I wouldn't want to characterize
it. He wrote
a
wonderful book called The History of the Footnote, which
he's brilliant.
Love.
Everything he writes is brilliant. I think that might be the only two sentences that I would ever take exception from.
I can find a few others.
But one has to change with the times, obviously. You can't ignore the fact that the digital era, as Bruno Racine said in his most recent book on Google, is as transformative and more transformative than Gutenberg. It just is. It's changed many, many of the equations. But I can talk about this library as being a place that's really alive, not simply in terms of what's happening in the public libraries in our system, but what's happening in our research libraries. It's true that Google Books is having a profound effect on all of us who do research and write. It's a phenomenally important advent in accessing information that would be very, very difficult to come by, or impossible to come by otherwise. And it does account here, and in many, many large-scale research libraries in America, regardless of the sector, it does account for a significant diminution in the consultation of printed books, especially those not covered by copyright, a vast, vast number of which have been captured in Google Books and that are available in the
And you have some amazing statistics about how much the books that have been digitized by Google are used here at the library.
I do. We were one of the five founding libraries in the Google Books project, but the quantity of material that we have submitted is quite small, 300,000 volumes. And your book hasn't been translated into English, has it?
No, I asked Chinese. Bruno Racine, and he said only in Chinese.
It really...
No,
but
probably Arabic.
It really... Well, when I was looking at it, I said to myself, if it's not been translated, I'll translate it. It's really one of the smartest statements I've read anywhere. It's the smartest statement I've read anywhere about the significance of Google, about the complexity of the relationships between participating libraries in Google, about the complexity of the legal issues and so on and so forth, but also about the benefits of what they've created and the power and the utility of that and how much more effective it makes us as readers and writers. A simple fact, and this is the one that Paul is alluding to, is the fact that if your books are put online, they will be used in a way and more often, and maybe more deeply, than they were ever used before. So you blast open a collection by scanning it. No, not only with Google, but with any other organization. So there are a number of databases in 18th century English texts, for instance, where there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of things that have been scanned. But you can do a search by keywords in a flash, in a second, and find things that you would never be able to find physically. Anyway, so we contributed 300,000 books, all American imprints were before 1923. I think the European imprints had to be before 1880 or 1890. Odd kind of stuff that nobody ever asked to see here, basically. I remember looking at the first volumes that were sent, and there was French sociology from the 1880s, that I don't think had ever been opened, and those kinds of things. Anyway, it turns out that this corpus of 300,000 books, which is part of an overall corpus of 15 million books that represent, I think these are the numbers approximately, that overall corpus represents 4 billion pages and I think 2 or 3 trillion words. That's the corpus of Google Books. 40% of that corpus is consulted every day. I mean, it's astonishing. It's just astonishing. Anyway, our little tiny bit, our 300,000 volumes, those in a year are consulted more often than all the physical collections of the four research libraries combined. Now, that's just amazing. It's just amazing. So being on Google, and being in Google Books, regardless of certain aspects of the controversy that surrounds that and the settlement agreement and so on and so forth, does get your stuff out. And if your orientation, as ours is, and as the BNF's is to have your material accessible to a worldwide audience for free, then that's a way to go. But that doesn't diminish at all the kinds of activity that are taking place in this building. I'm sorry, I'm taking too long to answer this question.
No.
Well, I'll just conclude.
Please.
What's now happening in this building is something really, really important and really magical and also transformative. What we're doing very deliberately as part of a new strategy in the research libraries is making these a place that writers want to be in and supporting writers in all different kinds of ways for short-term or long-term stays with us. The signature element in that has been the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, 15 scholars or writers a year with a significant stipend to write with us. And more and more important books are coming out of that. T.J. Stiles' wonderful book on Comrade of Vanderbilt that won both the Pulitzer for biography and the National Book Award for nonfiction last year was written with us. But then we have other spaces that nobody really knows about unless you're an inside, or the Allen Room and the Wertheim Study. But we want to make more rooms where people can come and be with us for a month, for 6 months, for a year, and write. But more significantly than that, my sense is that we should let everybody who comes here and is going to be with us for a few weeks or longer, or any significant length of time, make their presence known in an online kind of register way.
You actually believe in a kind of a GPS way.
Well, I believe that what social media have proven is the importance of community today. It's like the fundamental reality that we all have to be aware of, that these Facebook and everything else link people together in a way that they want to be and that they enjoy. So my sense is that we want to link people together not only through blogs and crowdsourcing, which you might have seen we're doing now in the food section of this Wednesday's New York Times, but I think we want to create real, actual, physical communities of people here who are working in areas that overlap with other readers. And whenever, until recently, humanists have always worked alone. So when I was at the BNF, I sat in the same seat. Every time I went, I always tried to get the same seat assigned. And I saw people I'd been seeing for years all around me. I never knew what they were doing. They didn't know what I was doing. But what we want to do at the library now is make their presences known. So if you signed in and you saw on the screen there were 15 other people working on Hamlet here, or Shakespeare, or Elizabethan literature, or history, or economics, or if you're working on the Italian Baroque and you see that there are people at the library in the same week that you're going to be here working on the Spanish Baroque, Baroque theater, what have you, suddenly, and you give them a coffee shop, wow, it does something really special.
But you would have an opt-in and opt-out.
Opt-in and opt-out, yes, of course, you don't have to sign in. But I think I think that would give us a kind of whole new dimension that is consonant with the increasingly collaborative nature of research in the humanistic disciplines. And basically, our research collections are all in the humanities. That's what we are. We don't collect science or engineering or technology, these kinds of things. So all of these collections at all the research libraries are fundamentally, substantially, humanities collections. So we want to hitch our wagon to a new kind, not 100%, obviously. If you want to be a solo operator, and, you know, be monastic and write that way, fine, you can do that. But if you want to,
libraries are also partly a way where time can be slowed down, where you can read on your own, where, you know, there's a wonderful description by Winnicott, where he describes the role of mothers in society, which for me has always been a perfect description of reading. He says the goal of mothers in society is for the child to be alone in the presence of the mother. And I've always thought to myself, this is kind of a description of reading. You're nurtured, but you're on your own. The library is also a place de recueillement of where you are precisely away from social media. You're away from the onslaught, if you want to use that word, of all the things we use so much in our daily life. You know,
but they can also facilitate.
They can facilitate it. I mean, in New York City, I have the impression that, you know, half of New York City is davening with their Blackberries. You know, everybody's walking around sort of bumping into each other as they look at their screen more than anything else. And in some way, a library is maybe a place also to get away at times from the screen.
But yes, there would be a combination of both, and there are several speeds also now in the library. You have the time of slow reading, in-depth reading, etc. But thanks to the digital collections, you can access very rapidly to the information you need, and both at the same time. So that's why I think there will be always people in at least in research libraries, because it's although Google has shown that it's possible to digitize in a short period of time millions of books, we are far from the moment when all our collections are digitized, fortunately enough. But I think thanks, the main contribution of the digital revolution, as it is called, is the it enables us to perform certain tasks we couldn't have done before, at least in such a short period of time. But quick access to information and culture are two different things. And of course, the risk is that there's a confusion, and there could be a confusion between it. It's not because we are able to have very quick answers to any type of questions that we have that the human mind has made a progress. It depends on other
on the mind
itself.
On what you think is progress.
And yes, and the knowledge that you have accumulated slowly. Otherwise, it's useless.
Paul, a while ago you said, you know, we have to adapt to our times, and I started this conversation by quoting Paul Valéry. But there is a man out there who takes us right into the future. We've had him here, actually, at the library, and this is Kevin Kelly, who's a chief. I mean, his title is fantastic. If I could have such a title, I would love it. He's a chief maverick of Wired magazine. And in a long and rather utopian piece in the New York Times, Kevin Kelly writes the following. When millions of books have been scanned and their texts are made available in a single database, search technology will enable us to grab and read any book ever written. Ideally, in such a complete library, we should also be able to read any article ever written in any newspaper, magazine, or journal. And why stop here? The Universal Library should include a copy of every painting, photograph, film, and piece of music produced by all artists present and past. Still more, it should include all radio and all television broadcasts, commercials too. And how can we forget the web? The Grand Library naturally needs a copy of the billions of dead web pages no longer online and tens of millions of blogs now gone. The ephemeral literature of our time, in short, the entire works of humankind from the beginning of recorded history in all languages available to all people all the time. Now, I see you sort of nodding, and no. And is this a realistic fantasy?
Well, a law as in France has established legal deposit for the web as well.
Yeah.
So indeed, we are archiving billions and billions of pages for which use we don't know yet because the conditions are not clear, but. On the other hand, even if life expectancy is longer and longer, during your lifetime, you can't read more than a certain number of books or etc. So there's a kind of contradiction between what we can as can accomplish as individual and this huge amount of documents, of material, whatever. In the case of internet, it's the web archiving. It's interesting because potentially there is no limit. And in the case of legal deposit of books, which has existed for some centuries now in France at least, we can say for sure that we have all the books published in France in our library, at least for the last two centuries. But if we want, we cannot archive every page of every website, even in the French domain. So the word legal deposit in this case has another meaning. We have to make choices, to make a selection of what we want to archive, with the risk of not archiving documents which would be of interest later, and on the other hand, of archiving heaps of websites which are of no interest at all. But there is no fixed doctrine on this for the time being. What I try to explain in this book with this metaphor of the new world, it's a terra incognita. It's we over the next 3 years we don't see the future, and even 3 years, you know,
it's
just so far. The technology, the new users, you know, Twitter, Facebook didn't exist a few years ago, and they are a huge phenomenon now. So we are, it's like navigation à vue, if you try not to make errors, mistakes, but we are not sure that we are doing the right thing. So we have to be very, very, very modest.
So, in order not to do the wrong thing, you have decided as a French people at the Bibliothèque Nationale to archive, a bit like Bouvard et Pécuchet did, everything.
Not on the web, because this is not feasible. Simply not feasible. So, but for the rest, yes, in theory, it's every book, newspaper published in France. This is the dream. This is of the librarian. Nothing must be
lost.
Nothing must be lost.
Because you don't know if in 100 years from now someone might not find it useful.
Absolutely. And the hierarchy between noble literature and vulgar one, for instance, doesn't apply any longer. If our predecessors had eliminated many publications that they deemed vulgar or devoid of interest, research would be much more interesting today.
How do you react, Paul, to Kevin Kelly's maverick statement?
Well, I find it hard to just digest what's on Google Books, let alone thinking about this immense universe of information that he posits. There are just a few points that I'd like to make. One is that libraries have been around for 5,000 years, since ancient Mesopotamia, when people were writing on clay tablets. And they are the oldest cultural organization in human history. They have been the only organization that has preserved human culture across, not centuries, but the millennia. And whenever libraries existed, they had three fundamental principles: to acquire things, to save them, and let somebody see them. And most libraries have been closed, except to certain kinds of elites who had a chance to see them. And most libraries still today, great research libraries still are closed. The present age is a transformative one because it changes one of those paradigms, and that is the paradigm of ownership. A library always has been what it owns. And the information that it holds is the most precious kind of thing. And today, increasingly, what we try to do is to get our readers to the information they need, no matter who owns it or where it is. But at the same time, those three legs that form sort of the triad of functions of the library are still very, very valuable. Second point I want to make is that, I can say this maybe more frankly than I ever could before, but I simply have no tolerance for people who think that libraries are going to be an anachronism at any point soon. Are going to be an anachronism at any point soon, that this is somehow an endangered species. There's a report published by the federal government about 4 months ago that was funded by the Gates Foundation that showed that in the United States last year, 68% of all people in this country over 14 went to a public library. It's an amazing number, almost 70%, almost three-quarters of all Americans went to a public library.
Is that similar in France?
No, the percentage is less.
Yeah. One out of every three Americans went to a public library to be online last year. So if there's any organization that is really sort of deeply entrenched in American life, it's libraries. So to think that somehow these things that have been so essential to the welfare of the people in this nation are going to be somehow rendered obsolete because of the web or Google or any other search engine or even social networks, I think is sort of preposterous and doesn't really understand the lived condition of the average American, which is tough these days, and libraries are there for them. In addition to that, another point is that a place like this that has 62 million items or so, we have to remember that only a quarter of those are books, only about 15 million of what we own here are books or book format. The rest, like comparable collections at the BNF, are maps, prints, manuscripts, millions and millions of pages of manuscripts, ephemera, all kinds of things. And indeed, the books of the world may ultimately get online, and I would love it if that could happen in my lifetime. It would be an enormous boon, I think, to civilization. And it would also have an important preservation aspect, because that means that the books themselves wouldn't have to be consulted so much, and there'd be less wear and tear on them, and they'd last longer. As for everything else coming online, yes, it'd be fantastic. It would be great. Where's the money going to come from? One big question, a rather practical question, I think. Also, a very, very, very big cultural policy issue. How do we preserve digitally formatted information? Not for 5 years, but for 500 years. Now we can...
Turn to each other.
This is one of the biggest challenges we face, because we know that digital material can be lost, damaged very, very, very easily.
Can be, has been.
And when you change, buy a new computer, etc., etc. And we could even come to the paradoxical conclusion that in some cases, to preserve this material, we have to print it, because paper stored in... but it's not a joke. It's probably what we're going to do for some... Otherwise, preservation of digital data is a process. You know, you have to update constantly update the formats, etc., etc. Generate new files when you detect damage. So it's very expensive. You were talking about money. People and politicians in every country tend to think that they will save money by having digital collections, because they need less physical space, expensive machines, but less space. But in fact, we found out that the cost of preservation is almost as high as the cost of digitization itself. We have to store in different places for security reasons, several copies everywhere. So it's a big problem, and we are not certain that we have the good solution. When the BNF started the digitization 15 years ago or so, the CDs that were used would have been lost before the program was to be completed. So it was nonsensical. So now we have more mature solutions, but...
I don't know if you're aware of what Salman Rushdie did not so long ago. He gave his old computers mm-hmm. To Emory University, mm-hmm. and now people can go to the library at Emory University and look up the manuscripts, mm-hmm. as it were, which are, of course this isn't quite the right word, but the work of Salman Rushdie, and look up the sites that he looked up while writing certain of his books.
But Google, Salman Rushdie used Google as a search engine, perhaps it was Yahoo, I don't know, but Google has the records of all the sites he visited.
But the issue is interesting. We spoke a little bit about this before tonight, the issue of the final text, the fact that now with computers as they exist, mm-hmm. The whole idea of the génétique du texte, the whole idea of the evolution of drafts from draft to finished product has changed dramatically. Does this at all, speaking candidly if you can, does this at all worry you?
Yes, but before computers, many writers didn't want the first draft to be, they were destroyed by the authors themselves. And that's not new. Some authors don't want to show that they have not found the first draft, the final text.
They don't want it, but we store the first draft here in the library.
When they kept it, we are happy to have them in our collections. But I'm sure that we'll have some programs, softwares, which specially devised for writers who want the various steps of their work to be recorded. So that, indeed, those who want to study the genesis of a text will have all the documents.
I'm curious how both of you see the role of librarians today. Because librarians are really, and I know there are many here tonight, but librarians are, to a large extent, unsung heroes, and their role is changing quite dramatically. I think the job description, as it were, of what it means to be a librarian is changing. As you know, we're drowning in materials. We were talking about Kevin Kelly's picture of the world as it might come about, and maybe is already. Librarians' role has changed. As libraries change, librarians change as well.
Well,
I
think you're the second friend I'm going to disagree with tonight.
You're
the second friend I'm going to disagree with tonight. Tony Grafton was the first, and now I'm going to disagree with you in saying that librarians are unsung heroes or heroines, because look at the acknowledgments of, I want to say, almost any book written by a New Yorker. It maybe is going too far, but always when a new book is out, I look first at the acknowledgments, especially if it's written by a writer who lives in New York. And so frequently, almost invariably, librarians at all different kinds of libraries are mentioned. So they're acknowledged as being fundamentally important in the creation of texts for so many different kinds of writers. So that's sort of my evidence of the fact that they are appreciated.
So forget the unsung hero part.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, they're sufficiently sung, and all the librarians here should feel very happy that we speak about you very often and acknowledge you. But for those people actually who don't come to libraries to write books, but just to research and maybe just to read, and who don't write acknowledgments because they don't write books, I think the function of the librarian is changing.
Well, I think,
and I wonder if you have given that some thought.
I think 68% of Americans over 14 who went to a library, a public library in this country last year, were going in part because of what librarians there have done or can do for them. It was the librarians who selected the texts. It was librarians who chose, you know, what kinds of computers and software and databases and everything else would be available. It was librarians who organized programs for them of every different kind. So the function of a librarian has changed, obviously.
In what way?
Well, one used to be dealing only with printed material. So one of the anecdotes that we like to tell, and I especially like to tell, is that when Barack Obama was graduating from Columbia College and wanted to get a job in Chicago in a community-based organization, he came to the Mid-Manhattan Library. A librarian there found a printed reference book with all the places to which he could write. He wrote, he got a job, we helped him get the job, he's on record, we're very proud of that. So does one look at printed reference books anymore? No, one looks at databases. And so the librarians have to be skilled as guides, as navigators into this immense world of online information to make the search of the client precisely identified and then help that person get to the answer. They are immensely important.
So they have become navigators in some way.
That's the word I was looking for. Yes, yes, indeed. In fact, they've always been navigators, but now the landscape, the information landscape, is much vaster, it's more complicated, it's more nuanced, it's more varied, the formats are different, and there's so much more out there. But they also become, if I could just...
Of course.
add a footnote, they also become community builders.
They become what?
Community builders of like-minded people interested in the same kind of subject through their blogs. We have 50 blogs that our staff are doing now in all different kinds of subject areas, and they have sort of international collaboration between people all over the world on their blogs. They're read, they're appreciated, they're communicated with, everybody contributes, and so it's a whole new exciting world. It doesn't leave the traditional stuff in the dustbin because all those kinds of services are still important to some people. But I think one of the things that makes being a librarian at the New York Public exciting these days is a whole new approach to information services that incorporates the power of technology to get somebody to their information much more quickly and more efficiently than before.
I think the key word in what Paul just said is the word community. And in the digital era, new communities are emerging almost every day. And librarians, scholars, but also other amateurs, I would say, are an essential part of this.
And so the library, in some way, the physical space of the library becomes a community builder, a community center,
yes.
A place where people meet.
Yes.
A place where discussions such as this one happen,
indeed.
Where there's a freedom of exchange. Is that what the library of the future will look like in some way, already is looking like?
But any library now is going to be part of a network, of a worldwide network of libraries. And what is fascinating is that I've seen a moment ago the edition of Zola with his the changes he made, and we have in the virtual world we can recreate corpuses which are physically disseminated around the world, and because they have preserved this the material, they can also digitize them and then create those this second level, so to speak, which is not limited by the walls or etc. And an infinite number of communities can emerge from this. That's why, by the way, the blogs you are mentioning, we have to archive them, because it's the way the knowledge is being increased every day by this interaction between individuals who perhaps will never meet each other.
Paul, you said to me that one of the things we do very well today and that the library helps us do is retrieve. And you opposed retrieve to perhaps knowing in a deeper way. And I'm wondering if you could articulate this somewhere.
I think what I was talking about seems to be a generational shift in how youngsters are learning and absorbing information today. I'll only speak for my generation. I mean, in the schools that I went to, we memorized an enormous amount. I can still recite some poems in English and in French that were drilled into me. The first exhibit I organized at the library was on La Fontaine's fables, and it was called La Fontaine, the Power of Fable, and it was really a big success, quite pleasantly. And I used to go up to the exhibit hall every now and again to see who was there and how many people and what they were thinking of the show. And one woman said to me, she was a French woman, she said, it was odd that she was there for the following reason. She said, you know, when I was a girl, every time I was punished, my punishment was to learn by heart a fable by La Fontaine. It was sort of, you know, totally perverse.
And amazing that she went back to the exhibit, no?
But it seems to me that that kids today are incredibly gifted at retrieving information. We all are. You know, if I have to write a speech, I just, you know, I used to have to go up to the reading room to get the books of quotations to find just the right one by Cicero and so on and so forth. Now I just type in, you know, Google search Cicero quotations, garden or library. He said, if you have a garden and a library, you've got everything. So I mean,
no, and you have. I mean, I have a speech you gave, right. where you have some fantastic Cicero quotations. Yes, if I may read them, which I think you retrieved on Google. To be ignorant of what occurred before you were born is to remain always a child. What is the worth of human life unless it is woven into the life of our ancestors by the records of history? And then you have this wonderful line, which I adore, read at every weight, read at all hours, read within leisure, read in times of labor, read as one goes in, read as one goes out. The task of the educated mind is simply put, read to lead. And I find it fascinating, but the quotation I find fascinating, I also find fascinating that the way you found it was in a very different way than the spirit in which it was written.
I got it in the hundredth of a second. But I mean, that's the magic of all this stuff, that we become great at retrieving information. Does that mean that kids know less? You see these surveys of how many people know when the Civil War was and so on and so forth, and it seems fewer and fewer kids do. And I do have a concern that the web gives lots of youngsters a chance to be the most nimble kind of retrievers imaginable. We can all be that, actually. But not necessarily to have a deep cultural base of knowledge, actual knowledge. That's, I think, what I was referring to about retrieving.
Would you agree?
Yes, but this is a challenge for our education. Yeah. That's the biggest challenge, probably.
Right.
To give an example of this, we have a law in the French Parliament that defined what you call here the basic skills that every child is supposed to achieve, and among those skills there is the capacity to read one text, well in the great text of the French literature. It can be a short one, a long one. It's not the law doesn't say they have to know all the fables or a single one, but it means that.
What does it mean?
Well, it means that we consider that a child or a boy or girl of 16 years old who has not read, who has not been able to read one novel by Balzac at least once in her life, in his or her life, has not achieved the level of education which the nation deems a minimum. So what we are talking about is a revolution driven by technology, basically, like Gutenberg. But we have, that's why the librarians, but not only the librarians, have a responsibility. We have to turn this into a new step in civilization, which is a different.
But if this has become a law in the French.
That doesn't mean that every
no, of course,
every
I would challenge it by saying that it speaks to a certain fear, and the certain fear is that maybe we live in an age where we are perhaps quite easily distracted from the possibility of attention, of sustained attention. And I know that you are rather interested in this notion of an attention that is distracted.
That's why it's so important to have places like libraries where you are not distracted by a myriad of stimuli. Mm-hmm.
You, Paul, in
my own defense, I did read Cicero in high school.
You, well, that's why you were able to retrieve him.
I did edit a play by Voltaire for the new edition of the Complete Works of Voltaire about Cicero, and Voltaire played the role of Cicero himself in the private performances. So Cicero has been on my mind for a long time. But in all honesty, yes, but But in the old days, I would have just gone to the reading room and pulled out.
Is there a difference? You know, because I'm thinking of my 92-year-old father. I have both my parents are alive. My mother's 86, and there are two sentences that come to my mind when I think of them because I hear them comme une rengaine, like an echo. My mother, when I was about 17 or 18, said to me, and then repeatedly afterwards, she would say, "Snap out of it." And what she meant is that my friends wore black and dark black and were reading, you know, Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and life was either tragic or catastrophic. I mean, those were kind of the two possibilities. And one day she asked me if I had any friends who played tennis. You know, she was getting rather nervous. And so she would say, "Snap out of it, you know, just move on, something else, please. We didn't, you know, survive what we survived to have, you know, the Sturm und Drang every day, maybe every other day." My father, on the other hand, and to this day, at the age of 92, he retired last year. When people would ask him when he would retire, he would say, "I'm too old to retire." But he did finally retire. My father, to this day, will say to me, "Look it up. Look it up. Whatever it is." I mean, you know, like whatever it is, and I have come, of course, to realize that in part he told me to look it up because he didn't know himself. At some point, I thought he was just telling me look it up because he knew, but he wanted me to learn to look it up. But I think, and I'd like you to reflect about this really seriously for one moment, not really about what my mother told me to do, but rather what my father asked me to do and continues to ask me to do and what I'm hoping to pass on to my children now, is what does it mean to look it up today? And has the change of what it means to look it up changed the way we think, changed the way we learn, changed our approach to the world? Bruno Racine.
First of all, I think there was a very sound division of labor between your parents.
I will let them know.
Look it up. The child doesn't need a father or mother to search on Google or any other search engine. But what you can teach as a parent or as a teacher in school, how you can assess, make an assessment on what you find on the web, and to be able to pass a judgment on the quality, the interest of what you are reading. Indeed, with such a immense mass of information which you can have on your screen, on your iPhone, or your...
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
We have been granted the gift of ubiquity.
You must be taught how you make choices. And that's why librarians, again, as teachers at school, are so essential. This is not something you can learn by yourself.
I was with a library colleague this morning, not a librarian, but somebody who has a different role here, and we're talking somehow about kids and when his kids ask a question, and he says, I say to them, "Let's look it up online." So, same phrase exactly, and Wikipedia, which I use, a lot of people do, is now the fifth...
You're saying it as...
The point I want to make is Wikipedia is now the fifth most heavily used website in the world.
Right.
It's just gigantic.
Good or bad?
I think it's good. I mean, I have very good luck with it. Plus, I heard a really top-flight scientist at a symposium at the American Philosophical Society, founded by Benjamin Franklin, state that he was a chemist. And for chemists, Wikipedia is now the place to go to for scientific information and chemistry. Highly, highly, highly reliable. I was astonished. But it does have a level of credibility at the highest end of scientific research communities, apparently. So, I mean, the entry on Voltaire in Wikipedia is superb. Totally superb, I think.
Did you contribute to it?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. but I had an interest in seeing what it was like. We're still looking it up. We're just looking it up in new kinds of ways.
But does it change? I mean, I'm curious. I struggle against the nostalgic streak I have in myself. And so I'm just wondering, is there a difference?
Speed. Efficiency.
Efficiency, yes.
This is all, much of this conversation is about efficiency.
I mean, serendipity. Has serendipity changed?
No, I mean, I found, I'm sort of, in the summertime, I started doing some very, very preliminary kind of research for this book that I hope to write. And I found more serendipity on Google Books than I've ever found in anything, including a card catalog, including OpenStax, where the great romance of, oh, seeing what's next to the book you're looking for. I mean, I believe in all of that, but what you can find in Google Books is just beyond belief how things get put together.
We'll get to Google in closing, because you've written a very, as Paul said, a very thoughtful book about Google.
There are publishers and editors and agents here tonight. Somebody has to translate this book and publish
it's called, in English. It's called Google et le Nouveau Monde. You told me there's a new edition. Here is our library copy, which I can't take out of this library, but I have here.
Please
send me the new edition.
President Rashid must sign it before. Pardon? He must sign it before the evening.
But this one is the library, but we'll, yeah.
No, yes, I know. That's why I want him to sign it.
Okay.
Nobody can steal it.
Okay, you'll sign it to.
He signed all the novels the last time he was here.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Actually, we should talk about your novels, but maybe not immediately. Though I am interested in what you might write about certain areas of Italy I love. But where was I? I've sort of lost my train of Paul. In an article written about you, where you describe a typical Sunday, that was recently in the New York Times. You talk about deep reading, and you talk about slow reading, and a historian I very much like, Carlo Ginzburg, talks about the notion of slow food in Italy maybe needing slow reading. And you say, I get to read the New York Times methodically for several hours, with nothing else interfering, which is wonderful. I read the Financial Times. We're talking about really reading, not skimming. I suspect you phrase this statement rather carefully, and you actually mean something quite different from reading and skimming.
Well, I meant was that on the weekend, especially on Sunday, I get to read the papers the way I never can during the week, because in the during the week it's like this. You know, I really do flip the pages quite quickly and don't get to spend very, very much time.
And what is the difference?
Difference is unstructured time. The difference is not being at work, where there are a thousand things happening every minute, it seems, and not interruptions in continuous meetings and phone calls and emails and all these other kinds of things. And it's the freedom that I'm privileged to have on a Sunday, that I can structure that day in ways that I want to, and that I can set aside with Judith, who does the same kinds of things, and we both sort of decompress and read the papers. And it's like a vacation. It's totally liberating. And fortunately, on the weekend, the papers can really be very, very substantial in terms of not only the information they contain, but also the analysis.
Let me take you two presidents into the future. And imagine, I'll start with you, Paul, and then I'll ask you the same question, Bruno Racine. Paul, you're soon to retire from an 18-year or nearly 18 years at this library. I'm very, by the way, I would like to say this, very grateful to you for having given me this extraordinary occasion to present live programs here at the New York Public Library, and to believe that public discourse conversation is so very important. Yesterday we had Atul Gawande talking about death and dying, and one of the things he said was most important when someone is terminally ill is to have a conversation with them, to have that moment, and our modern technology, to some extent, he believes, robs us of this opportunity. So I'm very grateful to you for this opportunity of doing this here at the library.
Even though I'm not dying.
No. But we are having a conversation. You know, yesterday, actually, Paul was not at all morbid. It's very interesting to talk about death and dying need not be morbid. It's actually a subject, I think, of great inquiry and interest. The whole 16th century, 15th and 16th century, had these Ars Moriendi, Arts of Dying books. But here is my question for you. Paul Leclerc comes back to the library in 20 years from now.
When I will be old.
You will be older. You will be older.
Yes.
What?
Both.
Very good in that.
Want the question?
Well, I don't think so.
No, the question is simply, how do you imagine that library to be? What do you expect it to look like? What do you envision as, what do you think you'll find? What do you hope you'll find?
Know, to be honest, I've been asked on numerous occasions in my tenure here to speculate as to what libraries are going to be like in 15 or 20 years for various magazines, and I've always declined.
This doesn't bode well.
Well, no. Look, when I came here, the web was something that hardly anybody talked about. It wasn't a presence in their lives. Then it came along, and I thought this was...
You enabled it in many ways.
I suppose. I mean, we seized the opportunity. One of the images I like to use about the way that all of us here at the library have worked in the last decade and a half or so is that, you know, we were like surfers. We really grabbed the right waves, and we rode them with a lot of skill and with a lot of effect, good effect. But who could have... When I came, I was supposed to bring the library into what was then called the information age. That was my first mandate. And so... To me, that meant initially putting the printed catalog, 800 volumes, Roman alphabet only, into a machine-readable form. Then the web came, and so we created a website in 1995. And I thought that was the big revolution. But then Google came, or search engines came, and who could have dreamed of it? And that was the authentic revolution, I think, in terms of information transfer and manipulation. So I've always been very hesitant to speculate as to what things are going to be like in the future. I hope, just in terms of this physical building itself and its appearance, that it's at least as glorious as it is now in its cleaned way. And on May 23rd, we will flip the switch to illuminate this library for the first time. And it's going to look, I hope, as good as the great public buildings in Paris do when they're illuminated at night, because that was the objective, to make this library stand out as the kind
of place.
The
French are very good at illuminating their buildings.
Well, the Enlightenment started in France. But thanks to Hélène Chollino, who's here, who... as the New York Times Paris bureau chief, she wrote a piece on the man in the mayor's office in Paris who's responsible for the lighting design or supervision of lighting of all the public monuments in Paris. His name was François Jousse, and he sounded like a real cool dude and a character. And so through her, I contacted him to ask him if I could come to Paris together with the head of our vice president for capital projects to see what they do and how it works and why it's as great as it is. And he said, sure. So he gave us a tour of Paris by night. And then I asked Mayor Bloomberg to ask his counterpart, the mayor of Paris, to release François Jousse to come here and spend 2 days consulting with us, which he did. And we used an American designer, but we used the designer who did the lighting design for the Ampère pyramid in Paris to do this project. So I hope in 20 years it's as clean, as glorious, as beautifully lit as it's going to be on May 23rd.
What else do you hope? Because this library is going to be taken over by a new president on July 1st.
Right, but
and he's going to have a new set of priorities, right. A new set of mandates, and is going to carry on doing what you've done so well. What do you imagine? Speculate a little bit. Be a little bit of a Jules Verne.
No, I'm going to be abstract because I can't talk about the actual format or ways in which these things will take place. But the fundamental ethos of this library is immensely important to me because it relates directly to the French and the European Enlightenments. Because this building, you know, came into being only 111 years, actually, after the French Revolution. The founder of this library, a man who's not really remembered anymore, is a man named John Bigelow. Bigelow was Lincoln's ambassador to France. So we have two Americans, Franklin, who started the public libraries in effect in America by creating one in Philadelphia in the 1730s, was our first ambassador to France. Lincoln's ambassador was Mr. Bigelow. And then more recently, Felix Roten, whose wife was our chairman, was the ambassadorial couple. Anyway, Bigelow was a great, great devotee of the American and the French Enlightenments. He was particularly concerned with Franklin, and when he was in Paris, he found the authentic English language manuscript of Franklin's autobiography. It had never been published from that version before. It was published from a French translation that was translated back into English. And Bigelow was imbued with the values of the Enlightenment, which have as a core principle that in a democracy, people have a fundamental right to free access to information. Now, that principle is chiseled on the walls, the marble walls in various places in this building. There are iconographic symbols of Enlightenment throughout the building as well. And then chiseled on the wall above the mantelpiece in the trustees' room is a great statement by Thomas Jefferson about the relationship between education and liberty and enlightenment. He uses the word. So this building is really the physical embodiment of a fundamental principle of the 18th century, that through providing access to information and letting people use reason and rationalism, they can arrive at truth. It's a very reductive sort of statement about a key complicated issue of 18th century thought, but it's true nonetheless. And you put a whole lot of enlightened people together and you get an enlightened society. It's not as naive as it sounds or as I'm making it sound as a concept. And that's what we do. That's why this place is so special. That's why everybody loves the New York Public Library, because we raise all this money, publicly and privately, in order to give everything away to everybody who comes to us without asking for anything back and without paying a fee, except you, for this particular program, because we have to support the staff. But it's magical. And I hope this is not an exaggeration. I don't think it is. I don't think there has ever been in human history, and a lot of the reading I do is about the history of libraries, I don't think there's ever been in human history a great magisterial universal collection in a library that anyone could come to except this place. And I think that that's the thing that I certainly count on seeing when I come back at the age of
something. 89. Yeah, what was the word you didn't understand?
Except
this place, this is it. In the 5,000-year history of libraries, there's never been a huge, 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 great, great collection that was open to the world.
This is it, Bruno Racine. So, in effect, I think Paul is also saying that things are maybe different in other places, and perhaps access to information is not as easy in other parts of the world, perhaps maybe even in France. The publicness of the public library at the New York Public Library is great. The fact that it's so easily accessible. What will you expect to see in 20 years?
Well, as Paul said, I think the physical aspect of the library will be more or less the same as today. When we enter the BNF in 20 years, I think.
Do you think people under 16 will be able to
yes,
come?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure they will come.
You think so?
15, perhaps.
Like New York.
It has been a debate.
Has there been a debate about 15 versus 16?
Yes, or 14, but not the very young children.
Why?
Why? Because it's not a public... although I said there is a public part in it, it's not... we don't think it's a part of the National Library, of the mission of the National Library. This is the task of the City of Paris to have a network of...
And do they?
Labor. They have been in charge of this, so the City of Paris could do better. But this is a result...
This is a nice way of answering the question by saying no.
It's a result... You are very clever.
I'm not as clever as I just listen carefully.
This is a result of our history, because the City of Paris, until very recently, had no mayor, as you know, and it was under the authority of the government, because the French state was afraid of turbulences in the city. So the City of Paris didn't have ambitious plans in this area. It has changed a little over the last 20 years, but I think it's not... we can say that Paris should take New York as a model for the library, certainly. But it's not a flattery. Just to be objective. I think what is going to change dramatically is what we said earlier, that we have two libraries. We have the physical one and the virtual one. We are going to the community using the material of the library, which is still restricted to a few thousand of some ten of thousand people, will be open to anywhere in the world. This is something absolutely exceptional.
And I think one of the most extraordinary things about the revolution we will see is that people will be able to access our collections from wherever. In closing for both of you, in hearing about the conversation tonight, I got a lot of correspondence. And I got a lot of correspondence from writers, a lot of correspondence from publishers, I got a lot of correspondence from agents, I got a lot of correspondence from people who view Google maybe slightly differently than both of you do. And I will read you from one quite famous literary agent in this town a question she really wanted me to ask both of you. And it's about Google. If we are now in a universe of the ubiquitous scan by Google and by libraries, and or where libraries have earned their digitized copies, do we dare question the culpability of libraries in this theft of copyright material in the partnership with the paragon of the greater good, Google?
We never have scanned or given over to be scanned copyright material. We drew the line, more than a line, a trench in the sand, and we came nowhere near the edge.
So this is misinformation in many ways.
It's not about us.
Right.
Or the BNF.
So she goes on to say, and if libraries are leasing...
No, there is no culpability.
Okay. And if libraries are leasing e-books online eventually, will anyone really have to buy a book in the future? Libraries will be leasing books, yes, for limited periods, but with repeat loans, in theory, a reader would never really have to buy a book. So worry, I think, that comes from...
If with your library card you take out a copy of X from the library multiple times, you're still not buying that book. You can't afford to buy that book. 40% of all the New Yorkers who live below the poverty line live in the three boroughs that we serve.
Let me stop reading this note.
So
let me stop reading this note because I want. But is your you espouse the Google project, don't you?
Well, wait. This
it's more complicated.
This is very complicated territory.
Yeah.
The courts did not approve the Google settlement agreement, or it's not the Google, the settlement agreement between Google, the Authors Guild, and the publishers.
Do you agree with the courts?
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to weigh in on the intricacies of copyright law and orphan works and all the rest of it. I mean, some of this may be changed through legislation in Congress, or it may not. I don't know the outcome. What Google Books, I'm only talking about public domain material. The public domain material that is available now is a great, great utility to the world. It's there for free. Our purpose at the New York Public Library is to let people have access to our material physically and, when we can, online. Not only books, but images, okay? Parenthetically, the big step that we took initially was not to scan textual material, but to scan images here. Because nobody was doing that, and we thought we would build a very large database, and our experience would be useful to other libraries. So the digital gallery at the New York Public Library now has 800,000 images on it, all searchable, all in the public domain. Those are downloaded, those images, some of them, they're downloaded between 10 and 12.5 million times a month.
It's amazing.
So let's say between 100 million and 120 million downloads of those images a month, a year. Gigantic, right? So what we're doing is just liberating the collections in a new kind of way.
Freeing it.
Yeah, and so what Google had set out to do was for printed material the same kind of thing. The great stumbling block is copyright.
Weigh in on this, because I know that you disagree quite strongly with your predecessor, who believed that Google was kind of l'empire américain, the horrible American empire taking over the world.
Yes.
And you don't see eye to eye.
I won't dwell on this, but indeed there was a there were, I would say, raving attacks on Google in France, and I tried to adopt a more balanced position based on an understanding of the originality of the Google project. And of, I'm not an admirer, unconditional admirer of what they have done, far from that, but I think they have their undertaking is extraordinary, because nobody 10 years ago would have thought that we could have access to millions of books.
What are the parts you don't admire?
Well, on the one hand, the quality of the digitization has not been perfect. The references attached to the books are some can be wrong in some cases. These are details. No, the main problem I see is that it was not possible to accomplish, to achieve the objectives, which covers books under copyright, within the boundaries of existing legislation. So, but on the, I should add that I don't think it will be possible to maintain the existing rules of copyright in the digital world as they are. They'll have to take into account this new the new expectations of the public, which but what they have done probably is not beyond exceeds what was permitted. So, but this is for a large part an American problem, because in Europe we have never thought that Google could digitize books protected by the copyright. It's always about public domain works. And as Paul said, this is extraordinary for not only for researchers, but for anyone. It's something which is very useful. So my position was, we are fortunate enough at the BNF to have public funding for digitization, but within certain limits, of course. And given the magnitude of our collection, it's not enough. So I thought it was in our interest to have a discussion with Google about a possible contribution to our programs, but based on our principles and on our choices. And I think eventually that is going to happen.
Which are non-for-profit choices.
Non-for-profit choices, absolutely. No exclusivity, etc., etc.
In closing, Paul, you probably know this very famous comment by the writer and poet Borges, who said, "I have always imagined that paradise will be some kind of library."
Yes.
Do you imagine paradise in a similar way?
To me, heaven is the New York Public Library.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you very
much,
John. Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
It's good.